This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning and welcome. What a treat for you today, for us all. Dame Emma Thompson is on the programme and we go there, well, everywhere, because of her new film, something I will get to in more detail. But in what I suspect will become an iconic scene, at the end of this new film, Emma Thompson, for the first time in her career, and she's 63, stands fully naked in front of the mirror. And her character, a retired and widowed religious studies teacher and mother of two, looks quietly pleased. Having started the film looking at herself in the mirror and not liking what she saw, being incredibly awkward and doing that thing that women often do, you know, repositioning her legs, sucking in the tummy, looking on the side and just generally looking worried, it's quite the transformation. And in our conversation, which I recorded yesterday, Emma Thompson talks about whether it is possible to rewire women's brains to like what they see in the mirror, especially when naked. Now, of course, many of you will. Maybe that's changed also over the years or at different points in your life. Let me ask you, how do you feel when you look at yourself in the mirror, naked or clothed? Do you even do it? Do you like what you see? Or do you have a different response? Text me here at Woman's Hour. I'm always wanting to hear what you have to say. 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. Or email me through the Woman's Hour website. Also on today's programme, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Brandon Lewis, on wrestling control from the powers that be in Northern Ireland so that women and girls can stop having to travel to other places like England to access abortion services. We pay tribute to the renowned Portuguese-British artist Dame Paula Rego, who died yesterday at the age of 87, who, amongst many things, had a major impact with a series of paintings set in backstreet abortion clinics in Portugal. And trying to solve the perennial problem for politicians, blighting women's chances to fulfil their earning potential. All that to come. But first, Oscar winner Dame Emma Thompson has graced our screens for four decades. And as an actor, she's played all kinds of women, from her role as Eleanor Dashwood in Sense and Sensibility to her heartbreaking Karen in Christmas favourite Love Actually. But now she's taking on a very different kind of role. Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, tells the story of Nancy Stokes, played by Emma, a 55-year-old widow who has never had an orgasm. After the death of her husband, she decides to do something about it. She decides to hire a significantly younger sex worker, played by the Irish actor Daryl McCormack. You may know him from Peaky Blinders. The film, written by the author and comedian Katie Brand, focuses almost exclusively on these two characters in a hotel room talking. And other things too, and it features Emma's first ever nude scenes. I began by asking Dame Emma Thompson what drew her to the part.
The unbelievable script written by my friend Katie Brand, who sent it to me with one of those, well, I'm not sure, I don't know. Anyway, have a read of it. I sort of had you in mind, and I read it and just thought it was extraordinary. And Katie had just imagined these meetings from the moment that the first knock on the door happened, and written this incredible story, this examination of these two people who slowly uncover one another.
Yes, and I think at the heart of it is pleasure, female pleasure, and what it can give to you and what it can bring to your life. And we still don't really have that. And a lot of women don't prioritise that or feel it's their right to want that and have it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was asked recently whether that was a generational thing, but I think if, whether it is or not, it's persisted through the generations. I mean, I can remember my grandmother on my paternal grandmother saying that she thought she felt sorry for men because they had to have sex, they had to do it, and that was a sad thing. So she had clearly, she told me when she was 88, she clearly had never ever had any sexual pleasure of any kind, that she had endured it in a sort of what we might term Victorian way. I think that's a bit unfair because I think some of the Victorians had quite a good time. But anyway, only the men, obviously. Then my mum, who was Presbyterian, I think maybe had only my father was her lover. I think they had a better time because it just was slightly more acceptable. And also they worked in the theatre. So that was it was a little bit freer and more bohemian. And so that sexual pleasure was not necessarily discussed, but sex, homosexuality, different kinds of sexuality were a little bit more on display. Mm. Then my generation, I think we were bullied actually in lots of ways. All I can remember is Cosmo appearing to suggest that if you weren't permanently in a pink state of breathless ecstasy, there was something wrong with you. You know, the orgasm was always on the front of cover of every Cosmo. And I thought, why is this so important? And then my daughter's generation, some of them, I think, actually have a good deal of leeway and elbow room and discussion about it and freer mores, but not all of them. I've also had discussions with young friends of my daughter in their 20s that have revealed in their groups, you know, lots of women who haven't had orgasms, haven't experienced pleasure, feel that they have to perform their pleasure, feel that they can't be honest about whether they've actually enjoyed themselves or not, think that somehow blokes have got to be taken care of in some way. So you can't offend a chap by suggesting that whatever he's doing isn't much fun.
Or say just a little bit to the left.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, because I think what's extraordinary about this is it's going to be, as you will have already found out, I'm sure, not uncommon that some women have not had an orgasm, as you've mentioned, whatever age. And yeah, the idea of men accepting that and not being able to, of course, there will be some men for various reasons or conditions, but the idea that women, because of course you can pleasure yourself, the idea that women have not reached that point in some way in their lives, there's a sadness that you display in the film, an anxiety, of course, but a sadness as well. And of course, you mentioned religion as well there briefly, but, you know, what the message has been around masturbation and women and pleasure. I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, that's a process, shall we say, covered in the film as well. That's also something I'm sure you've thought about during this.
Of course, of course. We have, for all sorts of peculiar, but I mean, very powerful cultural reasons, managed to place in many ways beyond the pale one of the only things that's not only free, but really, really good for us, healthy both emotionally and physically, really good for our bodies. These feelings, orgasm or pleasure, sexual pleasure of any kind, is actually very, very good for us. And it's peculiar because we are obsessed with other forms of pleasure. I mean, we'll take our pleasure at eating or drinking to the most insane extremes. But we're very loath to discuss, I think, in any real or honest way, and especially with the young and with our children, what and where sexual pleasure really does reside in the body as well as in the heart and the mind. We don't talk about that. It's been so industrialized in order to, you know, sell back to us. You know, we discover these things and then they're taken away, made into things and then sold back. And I think that's a tragedy and a great loss to us all. And I think it's also the cause of huge difficulties and problems and at the root of a great deal of violence too.
Well, another thing to pick up on, though, which doesn't seem to be getting any better, is how women feel about their own bodies. And yeah, for those of us who have had the chance to see the film before it's out and see right to the end, there is this scene, which I think will become iconic, of you standing in front of the mirror completely naked after sex, not looking that upset with yourself. You know, it's safe to, you're sort of having a bit of a look at, you know, what your body's done, where it's at. There was so much without any words that I could get from that. And I really felt what a lovely moment. How did it feel doing that?
It's so interesting that you should pick up on how she's looking at herself, because I thought, how am I going to stand? How would Nancy, how, when she's there, what's she going to do? What's happened to her? Because the one thing she can't do is look at her body in the way that she looked at it before, that is to say, with judgment. She's got to be at ease in some way. And I worked out how I wanted to stand, very relaxed with a knee crooked, like the picture of Eve that Cranach did in the Adam and Eve, the beautiful medieval pictures of Eve just standing there with one leg slightly bent, looking very relaxed. I don't think that any woman I know stands in front of a mirror. Well, they don't by choice anyway. I certainly don't look at myself in the mirror, but if they do, they're constantly tucking or tweaking, or it's impossible. But Nancy, through the good offices of this remarkable and compassionate and humane sex worker, Leo, has reached a different point. She's looking at her body with a kind of wonder and an excitement, because she thinks, this is mine now. I can feel that pleasure again if I want to, and I don't have to make much of an effort. I don't have to change myself. I don't have to make myself acceptable. I don't even have to find a man or a woman or another partner. I can have that pleasure. It's mine now. And she therefore is looking at herself with a, I suppose, a kind of ownership and an acceptance that I think is very, very rare. When I talk to women, and as I do literally all the time, and they all say the same thing. No, of course, no, I don't like this, I don't like that, I don't like the other. No matter what their bodies are like, we're all the same. We are all dissatisfied. And I think that's a waste of our passion, our energy, our time, our money, and our purpose in life.
Have you found a way, having done that scene now, to, you say you don't look at yourself really in the mirror, but to feel differently perhaps, or change that? Is it something you think you can rewire?
No. I think that I was brought up with it from a very early age. I think that the brainwashing started when I was very young. I think that rewiring is a very good way of putting it, because I think those neural pathways have been carved far too deeply into my psyche, and that they were carved very early. And if you talk to mothers now, they will tell you that most children, female children, sometimes also male children and trans children, that's a different issue probably, but actually it all connects up with not being satisfied with your body, and mostly to do with losing weight, with being thin, yes, particularly with girl children. And that's a great, great worry, because of all of the great dangers that are out there for young women, and the mental health issues surrounding these obsessions, and the fact that somehow the iconography simply hasn't changed. I know there are some campaigns that are trying to change it, Dove and all of that, and even Victoria's Secret, but nonetheless, the iconography hasn't changed enough or for long enough to really affect the young. And it is the young for whom I feel the deepest concern. Mm. I mean, it's too late for me, but I deeply resent the fact that my attitude to my body and my comfort in my body was taken from me. I mean, I think literally taken away from me when I was very young, and I was never able to get it back. And I worked in a profession where I was constantly told that I didn't look right, that I didn't have the right kind of body, that all of the 99% male executives would not be interested anyway in that way. So that will absolutely be persisting. And of course, until we get much more parity in all aspects of production, and that will continue to remain the same. And in your, I mean, not in radio so much, but certainly in television presenting, you know, the issues remain the same.
Well, I mean, and yet here you are in your 60s, standing there naked, having taken this role, having been offered this role, written by a woman, as you say, Casey Brand. And it's quite a moment. And I don't wish to lower the tone, maybe it's raising the tone, but can we just take a moment to talk about pubes, Emma Thompson?
Yes. Let's go. Go pubes.
Because
go on it. On
you
pubes.
Know, this is the thing. You look at the information that seems to be out there. I mean, there are various studies, but, you know, a lot of people, a lot of women get rid of them. That's what they're also taught to do. You are standing there. I'm sure some people, you know, might zoom in and have a good look around once they see a famous person naked. I didn't do that. But What's your view on that? And how did you feel kind of preparing to be fully naked? Did you change anything? Did you, I don't know, go anywhere?
Did I shave?
I don't know. What was the plan?
It didn't occur to me to do that, but you're so right. I greatly regret the demise of the full bush. I think it's a great shame. It's just sad, isn't it? And men too. I mean, and that, can you imagine the pain? So I don't know. I mean, I did once do the full thing years and years and years ago, but really I regret it because I've never quite grown back to my liking. But that's also getting old. But the whole thing of we've got to get rid of all our hair is odd, isn't it? And probably not very healthy. I haven't shaved under my arms for a long, long time, but I do still shave my legs. I've just got into that habit. And when they grow back in, my hairs, I'm not entirely comfortable. And I go, well, that's brainwashing as well.
No, it completely is. I mean, there are a lot of taboos, I have to say, in this film. Hearing you talk about the demise of the bush is a personal highlight now of one's career. I'm sure we'll prompt many messages from our listeners.
I'm sure it will, yeah.
We'll have a whole discussion. I always like to ask them what they're thinking while we're talking. But I did also want to come to something else, which I was watching it with my husband, and he said, oh, God, when your character said, nothing to do with the sex, my son's a bit boring.
Yeah.
What if you don't end up getting on with your child? This is an interesting terrain. So nothing to do with the sex or the pleasure. She feels she can be honest with this new person that she's met in her life. Mm. How did you feel about that? Because the taboo of saying what you really think of your child to a stranger.
Oh, my God, enormous. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest taboos that the boundaries that she crosses is she says, no, my children, I don't know if I'd known. She says that she describes them as like a ball and chain. If I'd known, I might not have had them. I mean, he says, what will you have done? She says, well, I don't know, but I could have done something else. And so revealing her irritation and her boredom, but also her resentment and her jealousy, I think that is a very generational thing. And I know mothers of my mother's generation who didn't work and didn't do what they wanted to do because what was expected of them when they got married was to have children. And because women's work was still very much in the, you've really got to want to do this and you've got, and it will make you somehow unnatural and brutal in some way and brutalize your children if you choose work ever over your children. That was very much there. And I think huge numbers of women suffered greatly and their children suffered as well. I know many children whose mothers should not have had children, should have done what they wanted to do, big careers in whatever. It could be, you know, big things that they wanted to do that they couldn't do because it just wasn't done or they didn't have the money. You can't look after, I mean, the aristocracy is a whole other thing, nannies here and there. So that's a huge number. And Leo reacts very, very powerfully to that. You know, I mean, he finds it funny, but he also is, you know, saddened. We expect mothers somehow to always love and find their children marvellous, but it's not always the case, is it? And that's something we don't talk about very much at all because it's very unpleasant to imagine that one's mother might not love one in the way that you want them to love and also might have preferred to do something else.
Yes. Well, it is a big taboo and it's in there amongst many other things. Well, I've got you, Emma, if I may. You know, you have been very vociferous about some of your views over the years and you've talked very candidly and your honesty, you know, is always appreciated. And I remember you talking a few different occasions about the Me Too movement in the past. For instance, in an interview with the LA Times, you said, get a grip, guys, it's not rocket science. You just behave with respect and courtesy. Now shut up and get on with it, to quote one of your remarks. And I was just minded of course, the fact last week, Amber Heard, a jury found Amber Heard defamed her ex-husband, Johnny Depp, in a newspaper article in which she claimed she was victim of domestic abuse. Johnny Depp denied that and was awarded $15 million. And off the back of that court case, many have spoken, you know, not necessarily going into the details of the case, but about the Me Too movement being over. You know, that's the end of it now. And there's, you know, thoughts about whether women will go back to not saying things when there are certain issues. I just wonder whether you think it has set it back and where you come out of that, because, of course, the coverage of it's been, you know, back to back, wall to wall.
I haven't followed it. There's so much going on at the moment. And one of the things it's very difficult to do is judge an issue like the issues that the Me Too movement brings to the fore when you're dealing with very, very, very famous people. It's a whole other thing. So actually, one of the great issues to do with that case is fame and how fame, how people who are famous are treated differently and viewed differently. I would say that the Me Too movement is not going to be derailed by that. But in order for it not to be derailed, we just have to keep on talking. We have to keep on talking and refuse to allow it to be derailed by a case where two very, very, very famous people, which has been blown out of all remote human proportion by the press and by, that's something that can't be avoided. But, you know, a case where the two protagonists are that famous is not representative. And it's just very important to remember that, that this movement, which is about, it's just about human kindness, and it's just so simple, really, and has been made so complicated, cannot and will not be derailed by one case. And that's not going to happen, actually. It simply won't happen.
Dame Emma Thompson there. And of course, what prompted that whole conversation is her appearance in a new film, Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, which is in cinemas in the UK from the 17th of June. At the start of that conversation, I asked you about an iconic scene in the film, what I think will become iconic, certainly, is her standing, Emma Thompson, as her character Nancy, in front of a full-length mirror, naked, and how her reactions change from the beginning of the film to the end. And whether you do that, how you feel, you are being very generous indeed in getting in touch to tell me. I hate looking at myself in the mirror. I've always thought throughout my life, as soon as I realised I was ugly, I now don't even own a full-length mirror. Another one, as I've got older, I'm 42 now, I've definitely learned to love my body more and embrace my many curves and flaws, in quotation marks. I'm now pregnant and I'm frankly in wonder at my changing body and the amazing things it's doing to grow my baby. Women's bodies are wonderful and I wish we could all learn to accept ourselves as we are rather than trying to conform to what we think we should be. That's from Isabel listening. Good morning to you. Emma, just listening to Woman's Hour, my body's in better shape now. I'm 66. I've had two children. I've got better love life now and sex. It's amazing, says Susie. Oh, that's making me look forward to 66. I'm 43 and I can look at myself in the mirror, but not without my eyes filling up. I've gained a bit of weight in the last couple of years and I have been very poorly with anorexia as a teen, and being able to look at myself and be fine with what I see, well, it's incredible. And sometimes it's overwhelming knowing how the mind can recover from being in such a dark place. When I look in the mirror, I see a woman, reads this message, who's survived several operations and has the scars to show for it. I have no breasts, so two curving scars instead. And lower down, I had a total hysterectomy, so another smiley scar, as you put it. I'm 68, says Lynn, and would show my scars to anyone having to go through such operations who might be curious and for whom this would help. But Emma is very brave, letting the general public see her naked. Lynn listening in Scotland. And so they carry on. Brilliant messages coming in. How you feel, what you look at. I mean, there's just another brilliant one here from Kate, who's listening in Hackney in London. Good morning to you. I love this. I used to look in the mirror and see myself. Then I started to see my mum. And now I see my grandmother. It always feels like she's saying hello. And I like it. I like it too. That's a beautiful description. Thank you. Keep them coming in on 84844. Now, abortion was decriminalised in Northern Ireland 2.5 years ago following a vote by MPs in Westminster. I'm sure you may remember. But despite this significant intervention, abortion in Northern Ireland has been called a postcode lottery, with some women still travelling to England and elsewhere to access those services. The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Brandon Lewis, has stepped in, and last month he announced new regulations to speed things up. He's on record saying, "I'm determined to ensure that women and girls in Northern Ireland can access abortion services in the same way as those living in the rest of the UK." But what might slow down progress is the stalemate that Stormont is in once again after elections last month, the political tension around the Northern Ireland Protocol, and how the government in Westminster is handling it, all of which I put to Brandon Lewis. So how quickly will abortion become more available in Northern Ireland? I spoke to the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland just before I came on air this morning, and I began by asking him whether women and girls from Northern Ireland still travelling to England to have abortions should be doing so.
No.
Why
are
they?
The current situation is not acceptable. So health is devolved in Northern Ireland. And sadly, the Northern Ireland Executive has not commissioned these services. The Department of Health here has not commissioned them. We've been working with them over the last year or so. There is a legal duty now in the UK government following the 2019 Act. But we've been working with the Department of Health here. They've not supplied that so far. And that's why over the last few weeks, we've taken some further action to be able to make sure we can get these services provided. Because we've said, look, as much as this is a devolved area and somebody who believes in devolution, I'd like to see it delivered locally. But ultimately, we have not just a legal duty, but a moral duty to make sure women and girls here in Northern Ireland can access good quality healthcare in the same way that people across the UK can.
What do you suspect is going on? I know there's been a pandemic, but 2019 is certainly some time.
Oh, yes. And look, the pandemic is no excuse for the failure to provide services here. This has just been a refusal by the executive in Northern Ireland and the parties here in Northern Ireland to provide these services for women and girls. There's no two ways about it. Because I think some of the ministers involved in this fundamentally want to end abortion, don't want to have access for women and girls to. And I have to say, it's not just about abortion. For me, this is about access to good quality healthcare to make sure that people who need support get the right quality support, and not just the health support purely in the abortion services, but the whole support package that goes around that. Because obviously for some people where they need an abortion and need that medical care, they also need the support because of the situation they may be going through. So I think it's fundamentally wrong that that's not been provided locally.
We got a statement, I should say, from the Northern Ireland Health Minister, Robin Swan, yesterday. It reads, the Secretary of State's written statement, and talking about yourself and new regulations, are being given careful consideration by my department. I'm awaiting further legal advice, including with regard to a Northern Ireland Minister of Health's legal responsibilities under the Northern Ireland Ministerial Code. I mean, trying to diagnose what that actually means. I mean, you're just not being listened to, are you?
No, look, I think the Department of Health, and I'm afraid the Minister for Health here, is just fundamentally doesn't want to provide these services. That's quite clear. He's had plenty of time to do it, you know, a couple of years in reality. So what we've done now is there's been an excuse used here as well locally over the last 6 months or so, which is that the executive needs to come together. They couldn't get this is not to do with the executive not functioning, because before there was no First Minister, they were making arguments that the executive couldn't discuss this cross-community and various different things, when actually this is a Department of Health issue. So what we've done, I took some powers a few weeks ago, outlined we're going to take two powers. One is I'm taking away the need for the executive here to make this decision so the Department of Health can do it. So I don't know why he needs further legal advice, but you know, I think that's just an excuse to not take action at the moment. The second power that we're taking is the power for me as Secretary of State to legally be able to commission services directly in the way that I could if I was a Northern Ireland Assembly member and minister. So that will allow us to do it. At the same time, I've put together now a team at the NIO, the Northern Ireland Office, of experts in how to commission services and what they should be. Because obviously this is a medical thing. It's not something my department do. So
yes.
Brought in some experts who do know what that is so that we can directly commission services. So Department of Health, I think they've had more than long enough now. So while I'm putting that team together, while they're working out exactly what we need to do to commission the correct services, I'll give the Department of Health a few more weeks to do that. But I do mean literally a couple of weeks. And then we in the Northern Ireland Office, as UK government, we will commission these services. Now, I can't give you a fixed time frame of how quickly they'll come through, because I need to let the team who are the experts in this work out what we need to commission and then to actually commission it. But we will be looking to move as quickly as we can. I've seen, even just in the last few weeks, I've met some ladies who have been through the most dreadful, abhorrent situations. That cannot continue. I think it's morally bankrupt to not make sure the people here in Northern Ireland have access to these services.
So regardless of devolution, you will be able to wrestle control through the powers that you have, and within weeks, you hope, have these services commissioned?
Within weeks, we will take the ability to deliver those services.
Right.
I can't commit to how quickly the services themselves will be in place, because obviously we've got to actually commission them and get them up and running.
But roughly,
we will move as quickly as we can.
Within months as opposed to another year.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. I will be looking to move on this really, really.
In this area of healthcare and medicine, time is of the essence if you are
absolutely
seeking this sort of help. Because I was trying to understand, if you are in a situation where you do need an abortion and you're not able to access one, if you would be able to, you know, women will be making the decision about whether they have to make a journey or not. And they're probably going to listen to this and think, well, how long is it going to be till I have that service? But you're saying you can't quite say yet.
Correct. Look, and I wish I could, but obviously I've got to make sure that the experts, the medical experts, are able to commission the correct services. As I say, I want to move really quickly on this. I met people just a few weeks ago, actually, who have been through the situation of needing to have that early intervention. And actually, the way the system was working here, even where they could get some level of service a while ago, the way the system worked here meant by the time they got a response, they were already past the point where early intervention technically could have helped them. So that kind of situation cannot continue. It's not fair on the people who need the services.
And in case funding is used as an excuse, are you going to change how it's funded? You've previously insisted Stormont has the funding to do it, but what about Westminster coughing up the cash? Is that another block, potentially?
Well, the money to put together the commission of services that is something we're doing through the Northern Ireland office, but the commission of the services themselves, absolutely Stormont has the money to do this. And let me be really clear about this. Not only have I this year secured for Stormont's executive the biggest funding settlement they've had since devolution began, we've got them that extra money after a couple of years running of underspent. You know, hundreds of millions of pounds a year here in Northern Ireland are underspent. So there is surpluses every year. So the departments and Stormont itself absolutely has the money to deliver these services. No question about that. This has just been a lack of desire to actually get the job done. And that isn't good enough.
At the same time, you've got to be thinking about the Northern Ireland Protocol. Legislation which would effectively override the Brexit agreement is due very shortly. Reports saying on Monday. Is that right?
Oh, well, look, we've said in a statement just a couple of weeks ago that the Foreign Secretary made to Parliament that if we were unable to, which we have been so far, unable to get a negotiated position with the EU, that we would take action to legislate. As I say, the Foreign Secretary outlined that a
yes.
short while ago. We will be looking to lay legislation to resolve the issues with the protocol. This is about fixing the problem so that people across and businesses across Northern Ireland can get access to the products they need. There's not a single
That's your view on it.
Of course, the protocol as it is.
That's your view on it. Of course, some are incredibly uncomfortable about the idea of overriding an international treaty and provoking feelings of lack of trust and all of that. Is it on Monday that that's happening?
Well, look, I'm not going to set out timeframes at the moment. We are looking to introduce legislation. We think we do need to do that fairly swiftly because we're not seeing any flexibility from the EU about the implementation processes. We will do this within the law. We're also very clear, and I think one of the things that gets forgotten here, all the political parties in Northern Ireland agree that the protocol isn't working in its current format. And remember, the protocol is not even fully implemented yet. It is causing substantial problems for a range of sectors and businesses, and people in Northern Ireland not able to access products from the rest of the United Kingdom in the way they should be able to do. And we need to resolve that. We need to do that in a way that actually still respects the European single market, but most importantly for us is about protecting the Belfast Good Friday Agreement in all three of its strands.
Well, we knew about that when your government wrote this original agreement and certainly co-signed it. Are you convinced...
Hold on, Emma, let me just...
The Good Friday Agreement isn't new. That's my point.
No, it's not. But what's important and what's changed is it's the way the EU has sought to implement. So when the protocol was agreed, there were certain areas that were not resolved. That's why we had grace periods. They're still running. We haven't resolved those issues with the EU yet. So there's a point where if they don't agree, we've got to resolve them. There were other areas where the protocol itself was quite vague around how you implement, and the way the EU have chosen to implement it has meant that, for example, the Jewish community here technically can't even practice their religion. We cannot allow that situation to continue.
Well, I could talk about that more length, but I don't have that time, I suppose, at the moment, because I'm trying to understand, as you're across all of this and you're trying to deal with various aspects here, are you convinced all those 148 MPs in your own party who voted against Boris Johnson this week are going to back that legislation whenever you do lay it, as expected on Monday?
Well, yes, I hope all colleagues, and I hope colleagues across the House of parties, will want to resolve this issue to make sure that people, residents of the United Kingdom, the residents of Northern Ireland, can have access to products and have the same tax benefits as people across the UK. If the Chancellor recently set new tax levels to help people with the cost of living, we couldn't apply that in Northern Ireland because of the protocol. We need to resolve that.
Yeah, but if you have this issue in your own party, and of course there's, you know, the Prime Minister going out making big announcements about housing today, there's a huge push by your leader to get his party on side behind him. Is that not a worry as you bring forward what is to some controversial legislation, I suppose?
Well, look, two things I say to that. One is, in speaking to colleagues across our party over the last few weeks, I think all colleagues want to see a resolution to the Northern Ireland Protocol. I think when they see the proposals we're looking to put forward, I would hope and I would expect colleagues to support them. They're sensible proposals.
Theresa May doesn't like the idea of it, does she?
Well, let's wait till we see the details behind the legislation, and I would hope colleagues will support that to resolve these issues for the people of Northern Ireland. I think that is ultimately the key thing. And it is quite, look, there is no getting away from reality. This is a difficult area. And I think it is important that, you know, we've got to own the reality that sometimes in government we have to make difficult decisions. We have to make those difficult decisions to resolve substantial issues that are affecting detrimentally people in the UK. And we owe it to our citizens to resolve those problems.
Front page of the Daily Mail today, Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, ousting a Conservative peer as a Foreign Office advisor. Baroness Helena Morrissey, pro-Brexit, of course, former banker. She said Boris Johnson, very talented, he's just in the wrong job. What do you make of that?
Oh, well, I know Helen. I've dealt with Helen in the past. I've got a lot of time and respect for Helen, but this is one of those areas where we disagree. And the beauty of the Conservative Party is we're a very big, wide open tent. That means at times
wide
we'll
open at the moment.
Yeah, but that's one of the strengths of our party. I've been chairman of the Conservative Party, so I know, you know, the beauty and the strength of our party is having all of these different ideas and thoughts and people from different parts of the party. When we come together, we are powerful, we are strong, and we deliver for people across the country. And that's what we'll focus on doing. Look, I disagree with Helen on this. I think the Prime Minister is the right man in the job. I think he'll lead us into the next general election. As I've said before, I'm confident we will win that one.
Very confident indeed. Brandon, you've got a lot to get on with. Brandon Lewis, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Now, the renowned Portuguese-British artist Dame Paula Rego died yesterday at the age of 87. And last year, she had a retrospective exhibition at the Tate Britain. You may have seen it. I certainly did. And over a six-decade career, she was known for characters inspired by fiction, fairy tales and her own life, and for focusing on women's rights. I'm joined now by the Tate director, Maria Bulshaw, and the art historian, Lisa Modiano. Maria, I'll come to you first. Your thoughts this morning as people remember her, and perhaps with specifically a view on how she reflected women's lives in her creations.
I think we're all feeling desperately sad that Paula has passed, but also I think still incredibly inspired by all that she achieved across these decades. For many women and especially I think women artists, she was perhaps the first and greatest example that many of us looked to. Her presence from the 50s onwards, making extraordinary paintings and drawings of women's lives, both domestically and in the world, meant that she was one of the very few role models and kind of renegade aspirational figures that we could all look to through the 70s, 80s and into the 90s. And she has always in her work touched on those intimate, personal and political issues that absolutely define women's existence, but until recently only very rarely expressed in our art and in our public discourse.
I want to come to a particular series in a moment with regards, and it's also linked, of course, to our previous discussion about access to abortion. But did you meet her? Had you spoken with her? What was she like as a person?
I mean, everybody that's met her absolutely, I think, adored her and was utterly bewitched by her, I think would be a very good word. She came to the opening of her exhibition at Tate Britain. She told us that for her, that was the lifetime achievement. It was the absolute goal for her. She wanted to be alongside her peer artists, who, of course, until recent decades, were mostly men. Mm. And she always believed that she should be in the National Gallery for British art. And so she was able to be there on the opening night of her exhibition. She worked with Elena Kripper, our curator, very closely, supported by her children, Vicky, Cass and Nick in particular, who helped her realise the exhibition. But, and she was there surrounded by people that she had known, people that she had depicted in her paintings down the decades, and she was delighted. And even more recently, I saw her work at the heart of the Venice Biennale. In the central room, in the central pavilion in Venice, her son Nick was there. And that placement of her work, if you like, at the centre of our art culture is absolutely what her work deserves and what her achievements should have been recognised by.
Well, I mentioned about a particular series she's famous for, 10 large paintings set in backstreet abortion clinics in Portugal, which were a protest, a direct protest at the cruelty, as she saw it, of anti-abortion laws. The art historian Lisa Modiano is with us. Can you give us a bit of context? She started painting these in 1998, the year of a referendum on abortion in Portugal.
Yes. So in 1998, a referendum was proposed in Portugal in order to put an end to the estimated 20 to 50,000 illegal abortions in the country, which were posing huge risks to women's physical and mental well-being. But of course, it was rejected. And so a month later, Paula Rego starts working on this series of pastels, which is now known as her abortion series. And they depict women having backstreet abortions. And I think they're undeniably quite crude and shocking in some ways. I think there's been very few works in the history of art that depict abortion quite so graphically. But that was what Paula Rego was, you know, known for, her ability to depict these sometimes uncomfortable and taboo scenarios with this incredible sensibility. And I think these pastels are very much an example of that, because they're showing women, you know, squatting, they're in the fetal position, they're open leg, they're surrounded by household objects, which are highlighting the lack of medical equipment. And they kind of really show the reality of the situation. So they're brutally honest depictions of backstreet abortion. But at the same time, she depicts the women in a way where they're not meant to be pitied. They're meant to be respected. And they're kind of this compelling request to respect a woman's right to choose.
Maria, there's some description there from Lisa, but I remember seeing these in the retrospective at the Tate last year, along this wall. And it, you know, regardless of sort of where you come at this from in terms of rights for abortion, access to abortion, you know, these backstreet abortions were happening. She painted what she knew, actually. We'll hear a clip of her in a moment. And they were really arresting to be able to see like that, aren't they, Maria?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that is most characteristic, I think, of Paula's work is it hits you in the stomach and the heart, as well as posing political and intellectual questions that you answer, but that need to be answered. And I think the frankness of her portrayal of women in the most vulnerable situation speaks across the decades. Of course, we saw them last year as we were hearing in the US about, again, the challenges that are being posed to a woman's right to choose. And so they are works that speak to the need for women's agency and the need for women's control of their own bodies. And you know, the focus on the woman's body in all sorts of scenarios runs throughout Paula's work. And so I think they are works that don't only speak of the political moment that created them, which, of course, was so significant and forceful, but also speak to the challenges that women face across the generations.
Dame Paula Rego had her own experiences of abortion. Here she is talking in the BBC documentary Paula Rego, Secrets and Stories.
I had lots of abortions. Not just me, but every girl at Slade had them. And because in those days there wasn't any contraception or anything. And they didn't care, you know, the men didn't care. So we just got knocked up.
Did she draw and use her experience, Maria? A lot of her work, of course, has a kind of magical realism to it, I suppose, if you describe it like that. But was she very informed by her own experience?
I mean, absolutely. And you see her paintings filled with the people that are in her life. So her children are used as models, her husband, her partner, her friends, and her own experiences become the theme for much of her work. So there was another extraordinary room in Tate's exhibition about her own experience of therapy. Mm. Her depicted on the couch in multiple different settings. And I think that the magical realist element goes with that always being connected to and based on women's and her experience of the world. So, of course, she draws on Snow White, but she's informed by the Disney depiction of that fairy tale, yes, which she herself was visually so drawn to. And when she's talking about fairy tales, she's talking about the myths and structures and the power play that so often define how women are seen culturally.
Well, with regards to power, Lisa, final word to you, if I can, as an art historian. How impactful, going back to the abortion series, was that, do you think, in perhaps changing some minds in Portugal? Because then there was another referendum.
Yeah, so they had a huge impact. The pastels, along with the series of etchings, were disseminated widely, and they were shown in various newspapers around the country. And they have been credited with having swayed public opinion in Portugal. So they led to a second, well, they partially led to a second referendum in 2007, which finally legalized abortion. And I think Paula Rego was very kind of calculated and smart in the way she drew these, because she also decided to not show the women naked, which I think was an important detail. She kind of made it clear that if she had chosen to show the women unclothed, then less people would have engaged with the works, which were already quite, you know, graphic and hard to look at.
Well, and I'm sure some people, of course, you know, depending on where they came at this debate from, also profoundly disagreed, and they had an impact as well, because she wasn't afraid of, I suppose, provoking the other side of whatever she was standing on as well. But you're right to say that in terms of describing them, that they're clothed, and I understand they're actually printed in papers and you know, lots of, yeah, access before, I suppose, everyone was on their phones with social media, was granted to those images. Lisa Modiano, art historian, thank you. And Tate director there, Maria Bolshaw, thank you to you. Let's just come to a problem which I suppose in some ways could be described as a perennial, but also is on the political agenda for a range of reasons, not least a recent piece of research. Because if you're a woman and you are to have a baby, you're going to miss out on nearly £70,000 in wages over the next 10 years. That's according to new research from the cross-party think tank, the Social Market Foundation. It also found women on lower incomes face the biggest losses in earnings in their child's early years. Meanwhile, the charity Pregnant and Screwed surveyed 20,000 women this year, and 43% of mothers told them that the cost of childcare had made them consider leaving their job, while 40% said that they had had to work fewer hours than they would like because of childcare costs. Well, the Social Market Foundation has launched this cross-party commission off the back of that research to look into the costs of childcare and what can be done. Let me talk first to its director, James Kirkup. James, good morning.
Morning.
For a woman who gave birth to a child 10 years ago, what is the impact financially?
Well, when we go back and, you know, look at the sort of long-term survey data, you know, that woman will have seen over the next 9-10 years, her cumulative earnings on average will be £66,500 less than they would have been if she had not had a child. And we do that by essentially comparing groups of like-for-like women, one of whom has a child and one doesn't. So, and that's a combination of reduced hours. Because, you know, women, you know, these women work less, but it also it's missing out on wage progression. It's missing out on promotion. It's not being able to do work that pays more per hour as well.
Is there comparative data, just because of how things have started to slightly change with men taking a greater role, where men are part of this, part of family building? Is there any comparative data about impact there?
We don't have exact like-for-like data, but broadly speaking, what happens when men have children, they work a little bit more and their earnings actually go up. Right. Which, again, we don't know exactly why that is. It's partly because the household costs go up, we think, and therefore they are, that gives them a direct incentive to work more. There's some sort of anecdotal evidence that says actually, if you have in some workplaces you have a child who recognises a more senior and established figure, and therefore you will you're more likely to get promoted. But that's at the point of childbirth. There's a big, that's where the sort of divergence of working experience comes for women and men.
And with the impact on the earning potential, then going back to women, is it the cost of childcare or is it women working fewer hours because of that? Or how do those all play into this?
We're still researching this. It's a bit of both. I mean, it's the cost of childcare in some cases means that it is just not economically viable to do an extra hour of work because the cost of the childcare you'd have to pay for will absorb all the extra wages you get from the work. But also there's a flexibility point. I mean, the reason we started this commission for a number of reasons, I remember a couple of years ago pre-pandemic talking to a big employer in the retail sector who said, we've got a lot of women on the shop floor who we'd like to promote. We would like to promote them to shift supervisors and floor managers and store managers. And they often tell us, I can't do that. I can't because my current shift on the tills or on you means I can clock off at 2 o'clock and go and collect the kids. But if I become a shift manager, I've got to be in the shop until 5, and I can't do that because there's no one else to look after the kids. So it's a combination of just the sheer cost of childcare, but also not having a flexible, appropriate childcare that will support working mothers in the sort of higher earning jobs that they might well like to do elsewhere.
James, stay with us for now because I want to bring into this Ellie Gibbs, a senior mental health nurse working for the NHS with 2 children aged 1 and 3. Ellie, thank you for using some of your precious energy to talk to us this morning. A lot going on, but what about the impact of childcare costs on your earnings at the moment?
Well, I had to change my job initially because I was working full-time over 3 shifts, but I couldn't get a childcare placement that would cover those hours. So then I had to go, if I wanted to stay 3 days a week, I'd have to then, I dropped to 9 to 5. And then you also lose your unsocial hour pay when you're a nurse. And we have to stretch our childcare over 2 facilities as well. And when I worked out the amount I would be taking as a wage and the amount that would go out, now I've had 2 children, I'm taking home £100 a week. That's all that's left. And already with the first child, it was over the amount we pay for our mortgage. So I had to think really hard about whether it was worth continuing.
And where have you come out on that?
I think for our family and for me, I really want to keep working. I want to be a nurse. I want my boys to see me have a career. And they thrive in the childcare that they're in.
Yes.
So it's needed. But if the cost of living goes up anymore, we would have to reconsider. And if I was on my own, it would be impossible.
I know you do have a partner. Has he or they, tell me more, have they suffered any earning issues since you guys have decided to have a family?
They haven't. I mean, we did discuss it about whether he would drop his hours or not. And I did want to look after the children too. But he hasn't, no.
But you're going to keep going for now. I mean, of course, there's also that argument. I don't know what you think of this about. This is a very specific period, I suppose, where childcare is needed in a certain way and soonish will be school. I don't know how you're thinking of planning about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you kind of think it is a short period of my life and I want to be there for this special kind of, magical period up to the age of 4. But after that, I've got to think about how am I going to cover the hours from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Yeah, school hours still don't really quite work with work.
No, and even if I was doing the longer hours, like we're having to try and find childcare that goes to 8 p.m, it still doesn't work.
Ellie, thank you very much for that. Shannon Pice is also on the line from the Early Years Alliance, a charity which represents nurseries, preschools and childminders. We're talking about also the government response here. I mean, Boris Johnson in a question session with Mumsnet was talking about trying to help people trying to make this work at the moment. And the government is to consult on the idea of getting the costs of childcare down. One way to increase the ratio of how many 2-year-olds, for instance, a carer can look after from 4 to 5. What do you make of that, Shannon?
Hi, Emma. I think it's one of those policies that is designed to create positive headlines as opposed to positive change. We conducted a survey a few weeks ago of about 9,000 nurseries, preschools and childminders, and that found that just 2% of respondents felt that that policy change would lead to lower costs for parents, partly because a huge majority of providers would not relax their ratios because they don't feel that it would benefit children and it would be detrimental to quality, partly because the minority that said they might would put the money that they would receive from that into paying back loans, into giving staff wage increases, and into resources and equipment for the setting. I think that anybody that knows anything about the earlier sector would know that this policy is not going to create any kind of benefit for parents whatsoever. And I genuinely do believe that it is for politicians to come onto shows like this and be questioned by you and say, what are you doing? And they can say, we're slashing red tape. And when prices don't go down for parents, and I have a three-year-old at nursery, so I identify with everything that Ellie was just saying, then the blame goes on to providers. They will say, well, we made this change, they're clearly not passing it on.
What is the way to bring the costs down?
Absolutely. Investing in the sector. So we have what's called the free childcare offer. We don't tend to use to say that because we don't think it's free and we think it's more than childcare. It's early education. We have the 15-hour offer for two-year-olds and all three- and four-year-olds. And we have the 30-hour offer for three- and four-year-olds working families. The government has underfunded those offers for several years. We conducted a Freedom of Information investigation a few years ago. It took us about 2.5 years to get the government to provide us information on the funding for those policies. We have black and white documents which say it costs $2 billion a year extra to fully fund these offers. It's unaffordable. So what we're going to do is we're going to invest about $300 million a year, and we will accept, and this is in black and white, that prices will rise for parents. So this is a policy decision. This isn't an accident. So it's just this mystery as to why childcare costs and early education costs are so high.
So the way to save money for parents is to invest. It's to spend more, for the government to spend more. But of course, that then will have to come from somewhere else. Shannon, we'll talk again. We've talked before from the Early Years Alliance, a charity which represents nurseries, preschools and childminders. A Department for Education spokesperson said, and you know, of course, we'll get a minister on to talk about this, I hope. The Education Secretary has been clear that supporting families with access to childcare and early education is a priority for him, talking about Nadeem Zahawi. We're working with colleagues across government to look for ways to improve cost, choice and availability of childcare places. We've spent more than $3.5 billion in each of the last 3 years to deliver free childcare offers, including 30 hours per week for working parents, which is supporting thousands of families. But you heard, of course, also what Shannon had to say there. Thank you very much to Ellie Gibbs, a senior mental health nurse trying to make this all work at the moment with two children aged 1 and 3, and to James Kirkup, the director of the Social Market Foundation, for some of that data. Now, also, we'll talk again, I'm sure, as that commission gets off the ground. And a message here: I'm 87, I live on my own, and I love my body. Perhaps it helps that I'm partially sighted. Going back to our original discussion, thank you for your company. Back tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.